The world waits with bated breath, in a sense, on what Israel is going to do next after the Iranian attack on Israel with hundreds of cruise missiles, ballistic missiles and drones. A coalition of nations and Israel primarily were able to intercept that. But the question still is there. Is Israel going to respond? Joining us now, Ian Bremmer, one of the foremost analysts in the world, somebody who's been looking very, very closely at the situation in West Asia. We'll also be speaking to him about the situation in Ukraine. Ian, thanks very much for being with us. The fact that there has been so far no response from Israel, the fact that Iran let the world know that they intended to attack, was this done, in your opinion, as a means of right-sizing the attack on Israel?
I think they did their best. They clearly were trying to accomplish two different objectives that are very hard to do at the same time. They wanted a spectacular show of force. At the same time, they wanted to try to minimize the risk that Israel would respond militarily. That is a really hard thing to pull off. They did a lot to try to make that, to thread that needle, including, of course, a heads up to the Americans through third parties and exactly what it was they were planning on doing. But I think there will be an Israeli response. I think the important point is that it's a de-escalatory response. I think the Israeli response will be significantly more restrained than the initial Israeli strikes on Damascus that killed the high-level Iranian military leader that set all of this off to begin with. So I think that we are through the worst part of this episode. The broader war, of course, is a very, very different matter.
And the fact that Israel hasn't attacked, is that in a sense indicative of Tel Aviv's intention to not make the situation worse than it is?
Look, this was very, very similar to what we saw at the end of January, beginning of February, when an Iranian proxy struck and killed three American servicemen and women in Jordan on the border of Syria. And this was a nightmare scenario for members of the White House that I had been speaking with. It was what kept them up at night. And they waited, if you remember, they waited for a week for a military response, and they got information to the Iranians on what they were planning to do, again, through third parties, but that allowed the Iranians to take their people, their personnel, out of those countries. And the attacks were spectacular by the Americans. They did a lot of damage, particularly to the Houthi known military capability in Yemen, but not a single Iranian was injured or killed. And that helped to both deliver a message of seriousness, convey that this sort of behavior would not be tolerated by Iran going forward, but also try to keep anything from further escalating. And indeed, you may remember, after those U.S. strikes, at least since then, there haven't been any Iranian proxy strikes directly on American or U.K. military personnel. So that time around, it worked. Whether it will have a similar effect, what the Iranians are now doing on Israel, I am more skeptical. But I will tell you that it is very clear that the Iranians were attempting to follow that playbook.
Ian, the involvement of Saudi Arabia, Jordan, also several other countries, the United Kingdom, the U.S. primarily, also France, that was obviously very important in ensuring that not too many Israeli missiles went across. But is there a message in that coalition for Iran?
I don't think that this is a threat that these countries are going to attack Iran. In fact, the United States, and that's the leading military power here, basically with allies putting Israel into a bear hug, saying that, you know, your defense will have ironclad support from the United States and allies, and we will display that. But we do not want you to engage in an attack against Iran. And the United States will not support militarily, will not participate militarily in any Israeli strike against Iran. So if you're Iran and you're seeing that, I think it doesn't necessarily change your strategic calculus going forward, no.
Ian, the validation of the technology itself, the fact that this missile shield actually works, How significant is that, particularly for the future, if there are more missile attacks from Iran?
Well, it wasn't just the Israelis. Again,
yes,
it was Israel
sure.
and allies. And let's be clear that having several days of notice that allowed the Americans and the CENTCOM commander to go to Israel and coordinate a joint defense and get American ships and aircraft pre-positioned to be a part of that defense, not to mention the potential for other weapons to be engaged, defensive weapons. That's a big deal. And I think it's pretty clear that in a future engagement of Iran against Israel, God forbid, it is very unlikely they would have that level of advanced warning. Also, you'll remember that the slow drones were sent first. So, I mean, it was taking hours for them to get to Israel across Iraqi territory, while you've got the Israelis with their air raid sirens going, civilians getting into their bomb shelters. So even if a significant number of missiles had gotten through, it was very unlikely that a lot of Israeli civilians were going to get killed. Very unlikely you'd have a lot of casualties. So I agree that Israeli defenses are advanced and important. I also think the nature of this strike mattered greatly. Now, there's also the point that Israel, despite all of their advanced technology, had all of these people get killed on October 7th. And that also is something we should remember, that despite the best trained defense forces, border forces in the world, the best intelligence on a very small territory in Gaza that the Israelis know very well, as well as Iron Dome, they were asleep at the switch.
Yes.
And all of that technology, if you don't have adequate political leadership, is not going to do you very good. And then the final point I would make is the fact that the Israelis keep talking about an existential threat against Israel. And it is true that Israel is surrounded by enemies, and they are further surrounded by enemies that do not recognize their right to exist, many of whom are indeed terrorist organizations that are willing to target civilians and military with indifference.
Yep.
That's a big deal, but that is not an existential threat, not when Israel is by far the strongest military in the region. And we're not even talking about their nuclear arsenal. So I think all of these things help to provide us with some greater context of what's really going on here.
I had an interview with the former Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert just day before yesterday, in which he said it's the right time to end the conflict in Gaza. He also said that Israel should not be responding to Iran. Do you believe that there is a public sense now in Israel that in both cases this conflict should be kept to this level?
There's growing opposition to Netanyahu. That's been true before October 7th with all of the demonstrations across the country, unprecedented, and only have grown since October 7th, which sits on his shoulders. But that is very different from opposition to the war in Gaza. And a strong majority of Israelis across the political spectrum believe that the war in Gaza is necessary, believe that Hamas needs to be taken out, believe that the civilian casualties are overwhelmingly the responsibility of Hamas for their terrorist attacks against Israel, and also for their continued their military strategy of hiding behind and hiding under civilians in Gaza. Now, that argument is not accepted by almost anyone outside of Israel, but it is not just the view of the hard right that supports the Israeli prime minister. Also, I do believe that the events of the last week have helped Netanyahu. I mean, in the same way that his legacy was failing the Israeli people in a time of great need, grave need and danger on October 7th, and that was the most important thing he was responsible for, that now he has led Israel at a time of unprecedented attack from Iran. And not only has he defended them in extraordinary fashion, but also has built a coalition to help defend Israel. It was feeling very isolated, including, as you mentioned, not just the United States that would always be there, but Jordan and Saudi Arabia. That's a pretty big deal. And so I think if you're looking at what you expect from the future in Israel, it is harder to get Netanyahu out in the near term. And also the focus is, as yours was in asking me questions, we didn't get to Gaza till 10 minutes in. Yeah. And that does give the Israeli prime minister and the war cabinet a little more flexibility in continuing the attacks on Gaza, including even ground strikes on Rafah, where the Americans had made an ultimatum, don't you dare, a lot harder to follow through in an ultimatum given what's just happened to Israel over the weekend.
And Ian, as far as both Gaza is concerned and indeed Iran, what in your opinion is the end game?
Well, I mean, you and I can talk about what the rest of the world wants the end game to be, and the Americans, the Europeans, the Gulf states, Jordan, Egypt have had those conversations. It is a Palestinian authority with a technocratic government and a joint control of the West Bank and Gaza, and a security force not comprised of the Palestinians, instead likely external forces like Egypt and others that would be funded by the Gulf states and by the West. That would be a two-state solution that would be recognized by the world. The Israelis would probably have some limited buffer zone with security that would make it harder for missiles to get into Israel. That would be a two-state, that would be a sustainable peace in Gaza. Now, I don't think there's any way to get there in the foreseeable future. I think that the Israelis post October 7th have been radicalized and are not prepared to end this war until outcomes come that are almost impossible to guarantee. And absent those outcomes, Hamas is still going to have influence on the ground and with leadership. On the other side, you've got Palestinians both in Gaza and in the West Bank. And in the West Bank, there's been a lot of surveys. In Gaza, it's a little bit harder to run surveys right now, as you can understand. Yeah. But I would say the Palestinians overwhelmingly believe that Hamas is the most legitimate form of governance they have because of what's happened over the past 6 months. So, I mean, certainly the thing that has been accomplished through all of this bloodshed, through all of this, you know, the famine in Gaza, I mean, the horrific environment that the Palestinians are living through, and the never again violence that the Jews have seen, worst since the Holocaust on October 7th, is you have profoundly radicalized these two groups of people that live with one another, next to one another, for a generation. And I don't see any foreseeable solution that can be brought to bear in Gaza as a consequence of that.
Ian, does public opinion in Iran count in quite the same way as it does in Israel? From whatever we know, the Iranian attack on Israel achieved very little in terms of damage on the ground. And that's a fact that people in Iran would know as well. What sort of impact would the attack nonetheless have in terms of shaping public opinion in Iran?
Well, I mean, they showed that they could do it and they quote unquote got away with it. I mean, if I'm right and it's a de-escalatory strike that comes back from Israel, it's not very much, doesn't change the balance of power. You know, that's a big deal. Also, you know, Iran today is leading the so-called axis of resistance, which continues to strike the Red Sea shipping with impunity. Energy prices are up on the back of that. You saw that the Iranians also captured an Israel-linked vessel just outside the Straits of Hormuz. They showed they can do that. They showed they could do it again. The Iranian government has said that we consider this episode closed in response to the Israeli strike in Damascus against an Iranian state building. But the Iranians have made very clear that next time around, you won't have this heads up. Next time around, we can use hypersonics. Now, you know, how much of this is propaganda, how much of this is real. But if you're an Iranian, I mean, part of the reason why Iran took this risk, and it was a risk. Right? I mean, you're launching a few hundred missiles at Israel. I mean, even if you do your best to try to mitigate that risk, the reality is, there are a lot of people in Israel that wanted to strike Iran immediately. I mean, look, let's for a moment put me in the position of Netanyahu's government, not the war cabinet, but his government. And I now see an Iran with an 84-year-old Supreme Leader who we believe has advanced prostate cancer, and he's had lots of demonstrations internally, and his economy's not doing very well, and he's just launched this big attack against us, and we've knocked everything out of the sky with support from the U.S., the U.K., Jordan, and Saudi Arabia, right? And now is it's the unique opportune time to just take care of these guys. Yeah. Let's hit their nuclear facilities. Let's hit their military leadership. Let's hit their leadership. Yeah. And you know, maybe we can get regime change, but we can certainly bring them to their knees at a time that we have sympathy and support from all of these countries. That argument was being made by Minister Smotrich. That argument was being made by Minister Ben-Gvir. And I think, I mean, cooler heads have clearly prevailed in the Israeli war cabinet. But the fact that the Iranians were prepared to take that risk to help try to recreate a sense of deterrence that Israel, no, you can't get away with anything, I think that's important for us to understand. Look, it's the very fact that the perspectives, the political perspectives of these two actors are so radically different. So if you and I, Vishnu, are having a conversation about this, we have to, for at least a moment, put ourselves in the positions of those actors to understand what might look like it was a failure doesn't look like it's a failure from the other side.
Ian, let's turn our attention to Ukraine, because you follow the Russia-Ukraine conflict very closely. Just a couple of months from now, there'll be this very important attempt at a peace summit in Switzerland. Ukraine obviously wants the process to move forward, but Russia isn't attending. How significant is Russia's absence?
Well, the fact that no one's gained territory in the last 6 months doesn't mean that that will persist in the next 6 or 12. Certainly, the Russians have seen the difficulty that the Ukrainians have in raising additional men to send to the front, much smaller population. They just brought the mobilization age down from 27 to 25. That was a big political fight for Zelensky. They can't grab prisoners and send them to the front. They can't engage in human trafficking from other countries the way the Russian dictatorship can, for example. So also the fact that it's unclear how much military support Ukraine will get and will continue to get from the United States and from its friends, though not allies, in Europe. So if you are Putin and you're looking at that, and particularly you're looking at the upcoming U.S. election in November, where you might get a leader that is much more sympathetic to ending the war and allowing you to annex significant territories in Ukraine in order to bring about a ceasefire, you as Putin have literally zero incentive to negotiate anything until at the very least after U.S. elections, and possibly not after that. So I think that this Swiss effort at negotiations, while it's useful to continue to display that the Ukrainians want to come and talk and the Russians don't, and that helps the Western position in justifying continuing to support Ukraine, the fact is it will be as ineffectual diplomatically as the last Swiss effort, which was just towards the end of January.
And, you know, we were speaking about the end game in Gaza a little while back. What's the end game in Ukraine?
I don't think that Ukraine has to accept it. I just think that that's what's happening. And I think that's what's happening even if Ukraine does get large amounts of military support. I mean, I wouldn't want to project exactly, you know, where the conflict eventually gets frozen, assuming it does. But I fear the best case scenario for Ukraine is that they are partitioned. They lose a significant piece of their territory, and not just Crimea. Now, I am deeply uncomfortable saying that, because I think it's unjust. It's fundamentally unjust. I think it's not right that Ukraine should have to lose territory militarily to a much more powerful country, and they've done nothing to antagonize it. That's not the way the world order is supposed to work. Of course, it works that way lots of times across the global south. But in Europe, the Europeans, of course, thought that we were done with these sorts of wars after the Soviet Union collapsed. Then the Europeans were wrong. I think that's the outcome. But it might be much worse than that, of course. Ukraine might implode. The Russians might take a lot more territory. The Russians might be able to overthrow still the regime in Kiev as they intended to back on February 24th and 22. And I think that everyone's worried about that. I mean, there's no indication. Putin told President Macron, told Chancellor Scholz personally, lied to them bald-facedly in the weeks and months running up to his invasion that he had absolutely no intention of invading Ukraine. He promised he wasn't going to do it, and he went ahead and did it. This man is a liar. He's a cheat. He's a war criminal. He's corrupt. He's a thug. He should be removed from power, but it's not going to happen. Yeah. So here we are having this conversation about what Ukraine should do. I mean, should. What Ukraine should do is get their land back. There should be war reparations, and Putin should be in jail in The Hague. But none of that is going to happen. None of that is even remotely going to happen.
Yeah.
And I think that's a very big problem for the state of our global order today.
And do you see India having a potential role in either of the wars? The reason I say so is because India has very good relations with Iran, with Israel as well, historically with the Palestinian movement. We have excellent relations, obviously, with Russia, Ukraine as well. So in the case of both these conflicts, do you believe that India can be a broker for peace?
I think India has shown itself as being a very capable leader when it chaired the G20. India increasingly is not trying to be neutral, but is trying to be a so-called friend of the world, maybe a little less with China and Pakistan, but generally speaking, more with most other countries out there. And certainly when you talk about both Russia and Ukraine and Israel, Palestine, and Iran, India is more credible as a honest broker than most other countries in the world are, including the United States. Now, credible as an honest broker does not equate to diplomatically capable, does not equate to militarily powerful, does not equate to uniquely influential in terms of pushing actors to do what you want them to do. But as an honest broker, India is in a very strong position. And the more powerful India becomes, it's on track to be the third largest economy before the end of this decade. I think that helps. I think it's generally good for the world and good for world stability that India has a larger voice and larger diplomatic ambition today than it did when I was in grad school. I think it's a great thing, and I'd like to see them do more.
All right, Ian Bremmer, wonderful speaking to you. Thank you very much for speaking to us. Well, that's all the time that we have on Left, Right and Center. From all of us here, goodbye.